Hey everyone, it's Carolyn here. You're about to enjoy 55 glorious minutes of the kind of passionate, insightful, funny conversation that you've come to expect from Feminist Frequency Radio. But before we get to that, let me bend your ear for just a moment. As you, our wonderful fans and supporters, probably know, everything Feminist Frequency produces costs money. From this very podcast, to the brand new season of The Freak Show, to so many other great video series, workshops, and other awesome Feminist Frequency programming we have in the works. Now, May has arrived and spring is in the air, which means that it's time for our annual fundraising campaign. This year, we've set a goal of $35,000 so that we can continue doing our vital work, and we know that with your help, we can make this happen. So head on over to feministfrequency.com/donate and help us reach our goal. Thank you so much. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy the show.
One of the first things I want to note, Carol, is that I cannot wait for you to see the movie because you are in the film. I did not know that you were going to be in the film, but...
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Feminist Frequency Radio. This is episode 24. Our fearless leader, Anita, is out this week, so you've got me, Carolyn Pettit, on the wheels of steel. And, of course, I'm joined by my valiant co-host, Ebony Astor. Hey, Ebony.
Hey, Carol. Would it be a problem for you to refer to me as Ebony Maw throughout...
Ebony Maw!
Well, not just the rest of this show.
Sure.
But from now on.
You got it. Ebony Maw.
Cool.
We'll talk a little bit about what that means a little bit later. As you probably all know by now, this is the show that asks you to be critical of the media you love, or alternatively, we're the feminist killjoys coming for your medias. Depending on your perspective. On today's show, we're going to talk about the Marvel Cinematic Universe class reunion that is Avengers Infinity War. And... On a less colorful note, we're going to talk about the horrifying phenomenon of incel culture and the ways that women, as usual, get blamed for their own victimization. As always, we'll finish the show by each sharing a little something in What's Your Freakout? And especially for our fantastic drip backers, we'll be recording a bonus segment. This week, we're going to talk about Michelle Wolf's appearance at the White House Correspondents' Dinner and discuss that old evergreen question... Are women funny? Can women actually be funny? I don't know.
Oh my God. The way you asked that question was, okay.
See, women are funny. Women can be funny.
That's right,
I just
that's
proved
right.
it. It's proven.
Exactly.
Everything Feminist Frequency produces, including this very podcast that you are listening to right this moment, is listener, reader, and fan supported. Thank you for helping us stay on the air and on the web. If you want access to special perks and exclusive back rewards, join our podcast community at d.rip/femfreak. Now, on with the show. So, Ebony, you just got back from, like, New York. Of course, y'all recorded the podcast there at Kickstarter last week. But also, while you were there, you had the opportunity at the Tribeca Film Festival to see this new documentary called Netizens, right? Which Anita is featured in. Anita actually... She's currently in Canada land, where she went to the Canadian, I think, premiere of Netizens.
Mm-hmm.
Also, can you, I have not seen the film. Can you, for our listeners and for me, you know, just tell us a little bit about what Netizens is?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the first things I want to note, Carol, is that I cannot wait for you to see the movie because you are in the film. I did not know that you were going to be in the film, but there are at least three or four scenes in which, you know, you are shown having conversations with Anita. You are identified as our managing editor. And I was like, yeah, let me, you know,
look at
my girl Carol
already.
Getting a little shine. I know. No, it's an uncomfortable film to watch, deliberately so, right?
Right.
So, you know, for those of you who don't know, the movie, the documentary is... roughly shapes, you know, itself around the stories of three different women and their three different experiences of online harassment, cyber stalking, revenge porn, and the sort of ways they've had to navigate that world, the reactions they've gotten from, you know, outsiders, legislators, you know, the kind of, you know, fight that they've had to have just to exist as a woman in the world, let alone a woman on the internet. Right. So Anita is one of those three women. And let me tell you something. I'm sitting next to Anita in the premiere, and I'm watching her having to relive some of the worst moments of her life. And there's nothing I can do to make this better. This is something that happened. But it was, I don't want to, you know, make it sound too trite or cliche, but just the kind of, you know, like thudding realization that like, this is a human being having to deal with the worst attacks and, you know, assaults and hatred. This is not some name on the screen. This is not an avatar, you know, with no reality. This is a human being. And the movie doesn't pull any punches, you know? The director does not sugarcoat any of this. And the women who tell their stories, they don't sugarcoat any of this. Like bad language is not bleeped out. You know, the
nature of the harassment is shown at its absolute. Yeah.
Gone. Galling, you know?
Well, I think it sounds extremely valuable because, you know, I still have those conversations with friends whose jobs and whose lives just don't require them to live on the internet the way that we do, right? They aren't big Twitter users. They just don't exist in that same space. And I think for them, still, when I talk to them about my work and when I talk to them about what we've been through and what my boss and friend has been through, they often just don't, they sort of, you know, they'll be sympathetic or whatever, but there's still this little hurdle of like not quite getting how this could be a thing, right? And so I think that a film like this could be extremely valuable in helping those people for whom these experiences are still just kind of like, you know, stories that other people tell or about other people's lives, but that they don't quite, you know, understand. I think it could be very valuable in illuminating why online harassment, you know, is one of the great kind of issues of our time, right?
And just the assumption that like harassment and vitriol are the price you must pay.
Exactly. Yeah.
To be a woman, a person of color, a disabled person, anything other than a straight white male, there is a price that you have to pay simply for existing, and for letting that be known that you exist. If you have the chance, please check it out. You know, just an incredibly important piece.
Absolutely. So let's quickly touch on a few pop culture news items from the past week or so. There is much, much rejoicing, although obviously tinged with sadness that it took so very long for us to reach the point where Bill Cosby has been convicted of sexual assault. Seeing the footage, I don't know if you saw this, Ebony, but I just saw on Twitter and stuff. Footage of the women who a small handful of Cosby's like accusers coming out of the courtroom after the verdict had been rendered, and just the grief, I mean the catharsis, but you know the grief, the, I mean just the outpouring of emotion that these women were experiencing in that moment was really, I mean, just so powerful. And also, you know, but still, as I said, so infuriating that it took so many voices being raised for so very long for us to reach that point, you know?
Yeah, and just the grossness of the conversation surrounding it, such that we were hearing people, you know, explicitly stating that, you know, they were more concerned about Cosby's legacy, you know, over the lives of these women, you know, who were, you know, materially harmed. Like, I just, you know, I say fuck you to people on the internet at least 17 times an hour. But anytime like this Cosby discussion came up, that got boosted up at least double, you know, just like, fuck you, miss me with that.
Yeah, yeah. One of my favorite tweets on the matter was, and I'm sorry that I don't remember offhand who tweeted it, but it was essentially to the effect of like, it said something like, do you know the names of half of Cosby's accusers? Do you know the names of like five of them? Can you name, you know, three of them? Do you want like an autograph? Do you, you know, no, therefore, like it's settled. Women don't do this to get famous, right? Because there's still this mindset of, like, women doing this to gain some sort of, like, personal notoriety or something, which is utterly ludicrous.
I can think a few things worse than having to accuse a powerful man
publicly, right?
You know, publicly, exactly. Yeah. You know, like, no one is doing that for the shits and giggles. You fucking idiot.
There's women out there almost certainly who have not yet come forward because of that cost. Also, really quickly, Joy Reid, MSNBC personality. You know, It came out that, of course, like on her blog, like a defunct blog from some 10 plus years ago, she had made a number of really, you know, disappointing, upsetting, homophobic statements. And what the problem with this whole affair is not just that she made those statements at the time, but that when they were brought to light, she essentially said that, oh, her blog had been hacked and these statements had been added. And I think now she's come out and, like, apologized for those statements, but it's disappointing that, like, I mean obviously I'm not happy that those statements were ever made, but I mean, as a queer person in the society, you have to sort of learn to forgive and a certain percentage of the population as broader cultural ideas about these things are shift. But, you know, so what's really troubling isn't so much that she made those statements, but just that she, you know, in that moment, rather than just owning up and apologizing for them, that she did initially kind of try to deflect that responsibility and lie about the.
Yeah, see, I'm confused because I haven't actually been following this story as deeply as I. Whatever. There's only so many hours in the day. So
oh, absolutely.
I haven't completely. But my understanding was, you know, that, you know, she did own up to some of the comments that she had made.
Yeah.
And so on the part of her defenders are saying, like, listen, it does not make sense for her to have owned up to some of them, you know, but to have not done the other. So when the story became that Joy Reid and her camp were saying that she had been hacked, and then people saying, no, it's not possible for her to have been hacked, but then the person who provided the screenshots, you know, had to admit that he had in fact adjusted the screenshots, had modified them. So then there was a question about, you know, how legitimate are these things, and would Joy Reid, like, is there any benefit to giving her, you know, a little bit of the benefit of the doubt while this story, you know, gets unpacked? So I am reserving judgment. Listen, y'all ready? No, I'm ready to wield the ban hammer in life outside of our Twitch stream, but just on my Twitter feed with abandon. So I am ready to cancel anybody from my regard. But just for me personally, because I haven't read up on the story, I'm going to do my homework and then I'll come out. Like, people give a shit what I think about Joy Reid. I'm acting waiting for the news.
Ebony,
right?
We'll check in with you again next week about
okay.
your feelings.
Okay, good.
Your feelings on the Joy Reid
okay,
affair.
Okay, perfect.
All right, so let's get to the main event here of this week's podcast. Avengers Infinity War, the big new Marvel Cinematic Universe bonanza, right? I mean, this film's got, you know, almost
everyone
in it. I think, I mean, Ant-Man, I don't think makes an appearance, right? But gets a passing mention, but everybody.
Surprise, you were in the netizens doc. Also, you were in Marvel Infinity War. I don't know if you caught
yet. Yeah.
But literally everybody is in this movie.
I'm one of the I'm one of the 50% of people who gets wiped out at the end of the movie. Spoilers. but we have to talk about the ending of this film as part of our conversation about it. So, yes. There will be spoilers, she says after releasing a spoiler for the film.
Oh my god! But, like, I haven't processed it enough. Like, I saw the film yesterday.
Yeah, me too.
And so it's been, you know, like less than, you know, 24 hours for me. And to be honest, like, I'm still kind of like, what are you? What?
Yeah,
I am very much, well, you know, in that mindset.
So I mean, I think for me, you know, it's hard for me not to admire some of the the craft of these films, right? I mean, this film, it's kind of a tremendous undertaking that it tries to cram in so many characters and so many little emotional, you know, story beats and plot lines and everything. And yet, like, I feel like the writers of these films have gotten the tone down so well that, you know, by now we know these characters well enough that even little moments with them are enough to, you know, involve us and to make us feel something. And I mean, there's one moment in this film, and I wish I could remember it better, where Robert Downey Jr., you know, Tony Stark and Spider-Man and Doctor Strange are on that this big donut ship flying through space, I think. And somebody says something ridiculous, as happens often in these films. Uh-huh. And you just get, like, Robert Downey Jr.'s face, like Tony Stark's face, processing this absurd thing this person has said. And the lingering on his face goes on not just for, like, 2 seconds or, you know, 4 seconds, but, like in that shot, it goes on for, like, a good 10 seconds or more. And I thought, oh, that's like, perfect. Like, yeah. The film actually lingers on that and lets us just, like, observe. He doesn't have, like, a witty comeback, because what has entered his ear holes is so absurd, so ludicrous, that even right. Tony Stark has a moment of speechlessness. And it's just like, and I feel like that's indicative of so much about these films is, you know, I mean, I'm such an admirer of Mark Ruffalo. So, and I feel like there's this really interesting, you know, I'm not in any way going to say that these films are models for positive masculinity, but
yeah, right.
at all. But I do think that I do enjoy the contrast between, you know, I think Mark Ruffalo, when he's in Bruce Banner mode, takes a kind of, like, I mean, a kind of sensitivity,
yeah,
that contrasts really sharply with, say, Tony Stark's kind of brazen, you know, confidence that itself also has moments where the armor gets chipped and he acts like a real person for a moment before the sort of arrogance or whatever, you know, the shield of arrogance reappears. You know, and other male figures like Thor and Captain America. Like, I just feel like I'm just grateful for that kind of, for Mark Ruffalo's performance and for Bruce right. Banner's presence in these films as this guy, you know, who has other virtues besides just being like, whose virtue as a man, it doesn't lie in tough, although obviously then yeah. he's the Hulk, so that's complicated.
But what's one of the things that's so great is that he is unable to pull the Hulk out, right? Like,
yeah,
he's unable to
film,
get
the
Hulk
yes.
to participate yeah. in the mayhem, which I thought was hilarious and
it was very
wonderful,
funny.
You know? But yeah, like you, like, I was really interested in the different versions of masculinity available, the different models of it available across the pantheon of superheroes we get. P.S. Side note, if y'all want to hear us talk more about models of masculinity, please listen to Cinema Ball, because we had a hilarious time talking about Kickboxer Retaliation, which I shouldn't even be mentioning these two movies in the same breath. Realize.
No, but I'm glad I was trying to figure out a way to work that in. So our film on this week's upcoming episode of Cinema Ball, Kickboxer Retaliation, I mean, it's a terrible film that gave Ebony and I so much to talk about
yes.
with regard to representations of masculinity. So please, you know, and, you know, we had a lot of fun with it. So if you haven't checked out Cinema Ball yet, which is Ebony and I's personal movie discussion podcast, give that a listen. You can find it on all the major, you know, wherever fine podcasts are distributed, like just like this one.
Yeah, and I think
yes.
you know, one of the things yeah. that we love about shows like Cinema Ball or Femme Freak Radio is that, you know, when we get to talk about movies or media like this, there's a way in which we're shining light on masculinity in ways that it is unaccustomed to having attention paid, right? You know, so people expect an organization like Feminist Frequency to want to talk about the representations of women. And yes, we absolutely do that. But masculinity is not a default. It is, it has been rendered invisible and normalized, you know, too much. And so you know, the ways in which we can pull back the curtain on how masculinity is a performance, you know, how it can be a costume that people wear. The more we can do that, the better. But yeah, so I loved like the different versions of masculinity available in this film. From like the dandy or kind of, you know, vaguely effete version of masculinity represented by characters like Doctor Strange or Loki, yes, to like the, yep, pure brute, right? You know, yep, represented by, you know, Thor and to a greater extent Hulk, you know? So I love that. And I also loved, again, going back to a discussion we had on our Cinema Ball episode about Kickboxer, the transmission of manhood. And male or masculine, you know, might and legitimacy from one generation to another is a huge part of this film with Tony Stark and Spider-Man, right?
Yes.
Like,
yes,
the kind of like, you know, Papa Bear way he takes Spidey under his wing, you know, is all about like, in a sense, passing the torch. And we know that ultimately something like that is happening. Like Iron Man, listen, Robert Downey Jr. is what, 55, 56? Like, dude ain't gonna be around playing this role forever. You know?
Yeah. I've actually been wondering how the Marvel Cinematic Universe is going to handle that inevitability.
Yeah.
You know, are they going to recast the role with a younger actor, sort, mm-hmm, of a la James Bond? Or are they going to try to maintain some kind of continuity where maybe he retires, Tony Stark, like, becomes some elder statesman, you know, someone like a, you know, who the other superheroes kind of consult with or talk to, but who isn't, like, in the field anymore?
Exactly.
You know, where is it going to go with that? But I think we do also want to talk briefly about relative to that masculinity that this film centers and you know, celebrates, how women are positioned. Because you have, you know, I mean, you have these amazing, you have these great, I mean, Scarlet Witch, right? She is,
yeah,
awesome. I actually... I don't think I saw the previous whatever Marvel film she was in before.
Was that Age of Ultron? The one that, like,
oh,
it made so
that,
much
but
money, but I have zero memory of that film.
But so you have, I mean, so she's amazing. You know, I like Black Widow. But these women and others, I feel like, are still, I mean, for all of their, like, power, and these are both very powerful women who do,
yeah,
exert their own power. You know, they save lives. They definitely have their moments in the sun. And yet they're both kind of positioned relative to, you know, their prime importance almost is relative to male characters. Like, Vision, you know, Scarlet Witch is there's an extent to which she's just Vision's girlfriend. Friend slash love interest, right? And Black Widow, I mean, there's like, it's kind of like, oh, Hulk, maybe the reason he can't be Hulk is because things are weird between him and,
right,
Black Widow right,
right
now. So it's almost like a big part of their utility or their meaning comes from the function that they serve relative to these male characters. And you don't really see the inverse of that. That same kind of like dynamic, right? So there's, you know, women, Shuri has like a few great, you know, moments and stuff, but obviously this is still not like a balanced, you know, universe by any stretch. It's very, very skewed toward men and, yeah, masculinity.
Yeah, absolutely. Although I have to say, at some point I became aware, this is how normalized it is, I became aware that I wasn't seeing a lot of women's bodies in the ways that they're typically presented in these superhero films. So, like, you know, ridiculous armor, you know, like, you know, crop tops with like a lot of bare skin, you know, a lot of like up the skirt shots and whatever. And I was so grateful, which is not to say that like Scarlet Witch or Black Widow, which is not to say that their outfits are not sexy, you know,
oh, yeah,
and specifically designed to be sexy. But the fact that, you know, we weren't burdened with it. We weren't overwhelmed by their sexiness first, you know. Was great.
Karen, your close personal friend Karen Gillan, who played Scarlet Witch.
Girl, oh my God. she's not answering my phone calls, unsurprisingly.
Yeah.
But happy to see her again.
Yeah, yeah. She actually has said publicly that she is unhappy with the amount of cleavage that her costume in this film, you know, reveals. And I think it's great that she is saying that publicly, that she doesn't feel that she, you know, I think a lot
Wait. Karen Gillan as Nebula or Elizabeth Olsen as Scarlet Witch?
I'm sorry. I got them confused. Oh, crap. I think it's Karen Gillan as Nebula.
Okay.
Yeah. Which I don't remember, anyway, what she looked like. But anyway, like, she did say, she did critique her outfit.
Well, obviously, it's Karen Gillan. I worship that girl. But I love the look of Nebula. And I definitely want to talk about the look of this movie. Because, okay, one day we're going to have to get my pops on as like a bonus, not part of the main show, not part of the main bonus, but like a bonus, because his movie reviews are ludicrous. And his take on this movie was hot banana soup, double size. But so I definitely want to talk about the look. But Nebula, she's one of the female characters that I love. And this goes to the different models
of masculinity. Is she the robot being tortured?
She's kind of the cyborg figure.
Yeah.
And I love that, you know, she doesn't have kind of like a superhero comic book woman's hair, you know, like her sister, Gamora, that, you know, like blows in the wind. You know, she has like that kind of, you know, bald pate. And I just love the look of her. And also, if anyone can tell me, like, if you are a comic book nerd and you know the answer to this, when she's in that torture chamber and there's that kind of like Silent Hill nurse cyborg character around her, who's that? Because I need to get a screenshot of that dude, because that was awesome. I loved it.
So just to correct myself earlier, because I did just Google it. Elizabeth Olsen slams Avengers costume, quote, "I'm the only one who has cleavage. Elizabeth Olsen wishes her Avengers costume didn't show as much cleavage," et cetera, et cetera. So I was incorrect.
She definitely has like a Stevie Nicks outfit, you know, like the corset, the long leather coat.
Yeah.
Maybe just because I'm into that Stevie Nicks aesthetic, I was going to let it pass. But yeah, she's absolutely right. Like, if anyone's, you know, boob is going to fly out, it's going to be her.
Yeah. So who is Ebony Maw?
Ebony Maw. Okay. Again, I don't have the background on any of these people. So Ebony Maw apparently is kind of a long-standing antagonist in the Marvel universe, in the comic books, right?
Yeah.
And so Ebony Maw is that kind of like, it reminded me so much of the Pale Man, or a character from Del Toro's movies. This kind of like tall, pale, very refined kind of villain, part of Thanos's team. So I'm not sure if Ebony Maw's actually from Titan, but part of, you know, like Thanos's team, right? And he is pitted most directly against Doctor Strange.
Sure.
But just very, you know, witty and intimidating, and in a lot of ways, almost that kind of ice cold villainy that's almost scarier than Thanos in a way, because it doesn't appear to have any motivation other than the evil itself, you know? There's no like rationale like Thanos has, you know, trying to reason away these atrocities. Like, it's purely about evil and power. So why am I taking that on as my alter ego? No one knows, but I can't resist. Ebony Maw coming to you live from FinFreak Studios.
Yeah. I do want to talk quickly about the ending of this film, or the final, you know, the final 15 minutes of it or so, because, spoilers. So Thanos does actually succeed in his plan. He gets all of the Infinity Stones, and he acts on his master plan for the universe, basically, is to cull all populations tremendously so that, you know, in his mind, it's justified so that, you know, scarcity doesn't become an issue and populations don't come to other ends, to other, you know, ends as they fight over what little resources remain on their respective planets. And so you have this whole sequence toward the end where, I mean, you know, like a lot of the heroes of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, quote unquote, die. I mean, they sort of turn to ash or something like ash. And I mean, this whole sequence for me it made me feel really conflicted, because I'm watching it, it's like there's that whatever part of my brain has the like immediate emotional reaction to film, you know, to the story, to the narrative that I'm witnessing. You know, there was this sort of lurch of like shock and grief as like, oh my God, they're actually doing it. They're, oh my God, you know, Black Panther, Spider-Man, you know, everyone, like, uh-huh. No, Kobe Smulders as whatever her name is. No.
Black Panther. Oh my God, Spider-Man, Black Panther, yeah. Kobe Smulders. Yeah. No.
Yeah, yeah. But at the same time as this is happening, there's already that mechanism in my mind of, well, obviously, this is all going to, like, we know, it's a fact. It is an right. absolute fact that this is all going to be undone, reversed somehow. Like, there's zero question about it whatsoever. Like, so there's, because, and it's because, you know, Marvel, Disney, et cetera, make billions off of these characters. And so, it was like, by committing to this ending for this film, it almost, to me, it almost had the, you know, the sort of reverse effect, I think, of what was intended, of, like, emphasizing for me how, like, this kind of franchise filmmaking, its hands are tied by, you know, capitalism and by everything. It's not, it cannot tell stories in which this kind of tremendous price is exacted. And it's almost like, now I'm like, I almost want to see that Marvel Cinematic Universe that moves forward somehow in which this, except like, bring back Black Panther somehow, because we cannot move forward without him now. For the most part, like, I mean, I would love to have that tragic, like, oh yeah, well, this happened and we didn't save the day.
Right.
But there's just zero
There are rarely narrative consequences, because there's always do-over, you know, written into every story, right? Like, you know, I believe Terry Pratchett coined the term narrativium. Like, these things are just woven throughout with narrativium. You just suspend your disbelief and you suspend your concern over consequences, because you know that ultimately things can be rewritten, you know? So it's kind of a cheat. You get to experience the emotion briefly, but you know that there's no real weight behind it. My assumption, and I'm 98% sure that I'm incorrect, but my assumption is that when we get to the next film, it will turn out that everyone who was, you know, ashed away, those are the people who actually were saved. The people who are left are the ones who, like, they're watching themselves be pulled out of the world. Because we know that Robert Downey Jr. is not going to be hanging on as Iron Man for very long. We also know that Chris Evans is not going to sign another contract. He's out of it. But so Black Panther is gone. Star-Lord got pushed away. Nick Fury, your girl, Kobe Smulders. Like, yeah. I feel like it's going to turn out those are the people who actually stayed. And these, you know, the leaders, Cap and Iron Man, will be saying goodbye to them.
That actually makes a lot of sense. I mean, I have to say, that is a theory that, you know, holds some weight. I look forward to upvoting your theory on Reddit.
Yeah, exactly. Can I ask you a question? This is in my final thoughts section of my notes.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's a reason, but is there a reason why Doctor Strange can't just, like, whammy Thanos into the heart of a sun or something? Like, he's always opening these portals and shoving folks through him. Like, is there a reason why that doesn't work? Is it because he already has the Infinity Stones? Because he can do some stuff against Thanos, but...
I certainly don't know, but I was definitely wondering about, like, the stone he has is the Time Stone, right? And so, like, does he not have the power to just, like, he clearly has the power to reverse time to some, at least small degree. Why can't he do it more to, like, sort of, like, let's move back to an earlier point and, like, plan and figure out how we're going to handle this, et cetera, et cetera. All these kinds of questions are, you know, I think these are the kinds of things that people just endlessly debate in comic book, you know, circles and comic book movie circles and so on. And we'll never get a good answer, but they can be fun to discuss. All right, moving on. Next, we want to talk about a few sort of current events or recent events that have brought to the forefront conversations about groups of men who refer to themselves as quote unquote incels, and you know, other sort of aspects of the victim blaming culture and, you know, rape culture really that we live in. I guess first of all, you know, the Golden State Killer has been caught, and as news stories are reporting on this this man and the, his crime spree, his killing spree, you know, here's an example of how media is like framing this. The Daily Mail, had a story, a headline that read, ex-fiance who broke suspected Golden State Killer's heart and, quote, sparked his rape and murder spree, is a travel blogger who went on to marry a successful accountant and is now in hiding. So this 100% frames the actions of this serial killer as essentially the result or the almost the direct, like, fault of this woman who, you know, who rejected him, right? And which is really, in my mind, like, a facet of rape culture. You know, I think back on, like, the Steubenville, was it Steubenville rape case, for instance, where, you know, as these football players, you know, were being convicted, media was framing it as, oh, what a shame that the lives, you know, the promising lives of these men, you know, have been now kind of destroyed, you know, rather than what the framing should have been, which is like, these men destroyed the lives of these young women, you know, And so
when you broached the topic for this week, you know, we were both kind of just like dreading the conversation in the way that, like, we just dread that this exists, right? But I think it was provoked by stories coming, treatment of the Toronto van killer.
Exactly.
And his self-identification as an incel, right? And how this gets, this, you know, feeds into this rape culture, this victimization, you know, blaming of the victim. So please, Caro, for the people who don't know what this fetid garbage fire term refers to, let us know what incel means.
So incel,
if you can do it without puking.
I'm going to try. It's difficult, but I practiced before the show. Incel means involuntarily celibate. And so what that means is that these are men who have such a kind of sense of entitlement to women, women's bodies, you know, women's sexuality, and who feel so wronged by the fact that they can't get laid by the specific women that they feel their position in society. See, so this is a very important distinction to me, because I think some people might hear this and think, oh, feminists have no compassion for, like, loneliness or, like, people who can't find, like, companionship and connection. And that is, like, 1,000% not it at all, right? I mean, I, like, you know, whatever. Let me get a little personal for a moment. You follow my Twitter feed. Like, I'm pretty open about stuff like loneliness. And in fact, some of that I have read, like, Bell Hooks has fantastic books like All About Love and Communion, the Female Search for Love, in which she grapples as a feminist and as a woman with, like, the lovelessness in our culture. And, you know, so I think that, you know, loneliness and lovelessness are issues that that feminists are deeply concerned about. But these incels are not men who are like, you know, gosh, I'd really like to meet someone who I connect with and, you know, can have a relationship with. These are, I mean, if you look at the rhetoric that they spew in their online, you know, dens of depravity, it's always stuff like, essentially, it's like a lot of them are like white, you know, I think they're primarily white cis dudes, not exclusively, but overwhelmingly. And they're like, because of that, they expect an entitlement to, like, they rate women on their appearance, you know, so they, and so on. And they, it's almost like they expect, well, that they should just any woman who's like an 8 or a 9 or a 10 or whatever, that they that should basically be their property. That they should have access to any individual woman in that group. And when they find that they don't, perhaps in part because they're such complete
horrible
assholes,
garbage people.
And, you know, who don't view women as human beings, maybe that has something to do with it. They, you know, I mean, Elliot Rodger was in this category. And in fact, the Toronto van attack driver in a Facebook post, I believe, like, cited and celebrated Elliot Rodger. Like, so, you know, I mean, they, now, I want to, so, you know, it's like, if you're a lonely kind of person searching for a connection, I mean, these men, they turn more deeply to the toxic messages of extreme patriarchy. You know, when actually, like, the patriarchy itself is what is kind of inflicting, to some degree, this harm. And it's like, you know, like, if you could,
yeah, there's never a recognition from them. Yeah, exactly. There's never a recognition that patriarchy itself is the problem, that it is a rigged system. It is designed for, you know, this kind of, you know, horrible fucked up valuation of people. But the and
yes.
Also crucially, these incels, although they rank themselves, right, and they call themselves like beta males, you know, as opposed to like alphas, who they call chads, but you know, so although they reserve some of their ire for these chads, you know, attractive men, financially successful men, physically dominant men, for the most part, their rage is directed at women, because how
Absolutely.
Dare, and only certain women, right? Like white, straight, young women,
conventionally attractive.
Exactly. You know, like, ain't nobody, you know, worried about, like, you know, if you were to adhere to their bullshit ranking system, none of these dudes are checking for fellow twos and threes or whatever, or, you know, C and D girls. They all feel entitled to the A's, you know, and the A minuses. It is fucked up.
Like, but I mean, but to be fair, like, I mean, some of these men are, like, would be or could be deemed, like, reasonably attractive, if not, like, quite attractive, but their ideology is so ugly and so hideous that, I mean, surely in their interpersonal, in their attempts to connect with women, like, that just gives off so many red flags and warning signs and is so unpleasant that, you know, it surely, yeah, interferes with their ability to form meaningful connections.
Exactly. But again, yeah, like, this, so the problem is with women having the gall to demonstrate, you know, autonomy and independence and not accepting, you know, what they're given. At the same time that these men also demand that these women, these prizes, because that's all they are, they're tokens, right? You know, at the same time that these women are, you know, it is incumbent upon them to resist the offerings of other men, right? So these dudes, these incels, will say, like, okay, as a man, I deserve, I must have, it is mandatory for my mental health to have sexual contact with whomever I desire. But the woman that I choose, or the women that I choose to, you know, to use as the vessel for this, must never have been touched by other men. Or
right.
Only infrequently, right? So, I mean, why am I even trying to break this down logically? But, like, the physics doesn't work, you know? Like, they all want, like, 18-year-old, you know, big-boobed blonde virgins.
Exactly.
Oh, my God. I'm losing my fucking mind here. I'm losing my mind. But the Golden State Killer business, this, like, this woman, we should be, first of all, ain't none of your business where she is, how she married, what her job is, whatever, right? But if you do need to identify this woman, which you don't, all you should be saying is, thank God you got away. Because ain't nothing she did responsible for. He had that in him already. She didn't make him a serial killer. She didn't make him a rapist. Thank God she got away. Thank God she wasn't one of his victims.
Yes.
More than she already was. Fuck that shit.
100%. And, you know, even our you know, Kanye's best pal, Scott Adams, of is like, you know, it sort of espouses this ideology to some degree. You know, in a blog post at some point, he wrote, lonely boys tend to be suicidal when the odds of future female companionship are low. So if you're wondering how men become cold-blooded killers, it isn't religion that is doing it. If you put me in that situation, I can say with confidence I would sign up for suicide bomb duty. And I'm not even a believer. Men like hugging better than they like killing. But if you take away my access to hugging, I will probably start killing just to feel something. Like, I mean, do you think that having that kind of attitude about quote unquote access to hugging, I mean, right? Like, is going to make that more likely? I mean, don't you,
the idea,
like, don't you understand that you are dehumanizing the hypothetical person or people with whom you might have such contact just by even framing it or talking about it in these terms? Like,
right. And like okay, if you don't hug, if you don't hug me, quote,
yeah, he's really,
I am going to
Scott
start
Adams
killing.
Like, what? big hugger.
Like, what an attractive proposition for any woman. I am the sort of man who, if I am not allowed to hug you, I will absolutely start
exactly
killing. You
know, like, so what?
Totally normal thing to say. Yeah, totally normal thing.
It's just terrifying, right? It's terrifying. I mean, like, being in that position where you're the woman who, like, feels some pressure to hug Scott Adams so that he doesn't go on a fucking killing spree or whatever.
Seriously. Like, I don't know how many, I mean, where do I get, I've been busy doing so many other things this weekend, Caro. I am worried that I have not sufficiently prevented various men in my life from not becoming cold-blooded killers. You know,
that is our role and our function as women, Ebony. It's time we opened our eyes to that reality and just accepted that. Although, yeah. Anyway, as
although,
if
well, I feel very exactly if, like, no one's checking for me. So.
Exactly, like, as if incel, as if I'm anywhere on the incel fucking scale of whatever. So let's move on to what's your freak out, or since Ebony is not around this week, we can call
That's
it
right.
What's your deal for old time's sake, Ebony?
What's your deal?
What's your deal?
What's your deal?
What's your deal?
What's your deal? What's your deal? What's your deal? What's your deal? Oh my God, this is why I love you so much, because you're always thinking of others. Yeah, I am. So my freak out this week is not, it is more of a deal than it is a freak out this week. Excuse me. So I follow an amazing academic on Twitter, and I'm actually hoping to get her on the Star Trek podcast once it comes back on. She has agreed to do it. We're just trying to figure it out. Her name is Ebony Thomas. Excuse me. And I think her Twitter handle is Ebony Teach.
Did you meet her at the monthly Ebony meeting, the meeting of all Ebonies?
It's me, it's Ebony Thomas, and Ebony Ma. We're the ruling council, you know?
Right on.
Handing down executive orders. But so she, excuse me, posted on Twitter today a link to an article that I'm really getting into. And so just a little bit of background. Before I, you know, jumped with both feet into the worlds of nonprofit existence, I used to teach. I was an adjunct professor for a bit. And so this piece called The Ugly Truth of Being a Black Professor in America was particularly resonant to me. And I encourage people to read it. It's by a guy named George Yancey. And it just came out, I want to say, yesterday in the Chronicle of Higher Education. So we'll put a link to it, but I just want to read the opening paragraph. Dear nigger professor, that was the beginning of a message that was sent to me. There's nothing to be cherished here, despite the salutation. Years ago, Malcolm X asked, "What does a white man call a black man with a PhD?" He answered, "A nigger with a PhD." The message came in response to an op-ed I published in the New York Times in December 2015. I'd spent much of that year conducting a series of interviews about philosophers about race. I wanted to hold a disagreeable mirror up to white readers and ask that they take a long, hard look without fleeing. My article, Dear White America, took the form of a letter asking readers to accept the truth of what it means to be white in a society created for white people. That tells you all you need to know about what's going to be provoked, right? And the responses. But it was, it's a hard piece. It's been, you know, shared and debated among, you know, black people and people of color, in academia over the past couple of days. And yeah, you know, as a person with, that kind of academic background and who has spent, you know, who spent many years in that arena, there's a reason why I am no longer in that space. But I just, I loved the way that it gets, you know, like the autopsy, the way the issues get laid bare here. You know, it is a hard piece to read. It is an even harder thing to experience and to live. So anyways, we'll put the link up there.
Yeah.
And I encourage people to read it.
Awesome. Wow. Yeah. My, mine is, more lighthearted, but, so I actually, the other day I was just at a local eatery, and there was this abandoned book, sitting there, which was called The Patience of the Spider. This is a 2004 novel by Andrea Camilleri. I'm probably not pronouncing that right, but it is one in a series of, crime novels about a Sicilian, investigator named Inspector Montalbano. And, you know, I've kind of fallen off the crime novel train for a while. Like I read a ton of Scandinavian crime fiction, several years ago, you know, tore through all of Henning Mankell's Kurt Wallander novels and everything. And I saw this book and kind of calling out to me. I sort of felt like fate, like maybe I was destined to find this book here. And, I'm still, you know, I'm still quite early on, but, it's doing some of what I really like, in crime fiction, which is it has a wonderful sense of place, you know? I mean, there's a way in which a good crime novel, part of what I got so much pleasure out of the, you know, the Kurt Wallander novels for was that there was a sense in which they felt like traveling to, you know, Ystad, traveling to Sweden, because you're sort of just living the day-to-day life with these characters, you know, the mundanities as well as the sort of the distinctive local color and attributes. And so, so far this book, you know, definitely it's portrayal of sort of Sicily. It makes me feel like a bit like it's an experience of travel to a place that I myself have not yet been. It has great atmosphere, great character there. And, you know, it's a sort of slender crime novel, which makes it feel a bit more like approachable to me right now, because I do have so much trouble sometimes squeezing in, the stuff that I want to engage with around a lot of the stuff that I have to engage with, you know, for this work. So, you know, I'm still reading it, but I'm getting a lot of enjoyment out of my early goings. And it's part of a series. It's sort of in the middle of this, you know, series. So I'm sort of just jumping right in to, you know, a character who's been by this point established for some time. But like most of these crime series, like The Case or the, you know, to some degree, like the novels are both like standalone in terms of, I think, the crime that is occurs and that is solved, but also the character, there's a continuity to the character's history and their evolution over time. So anyway, yeah, that's what I'm into right now. So,
and it's called The Patience of the Spider.
The Patience of the Spider. Yes. Part of the, as I said, Inspector Montalbano series. All right, y'all, I think that is gonna do it for our show this week. You can catch us back here every single Wednesday. We couldn't make this podcast happen without our generous backers on Drip. Drip is Kickstarter's brand new subscription-based crowdfunding platform. Help us keep bringing this podcast to you every week by joining the FemFreak community. We've even got some great rewards for you. Join us over at d.rip/FemFreak. And also, if you're enjoying the show, we have another small favor to ask. Please leave us a review on iTunes. It really does help spread the word about our show. And, you know, tell your friends as well when you're looking at each other in shock over incels and rape culture, and that this is actually literally the world we live in. You know, maybe say, hey, you know, there's this great podcast that addresses these issues and shines a spotlight on them, and I really get a lot out of their conversations. You know, you could help them make that happen over at d.rib/femfreak. You can check out all of our work and our other podcasts, including Cinema Ball, at feministfrequency.com. So be sure to follow us on Twitter at Femfreak to stay up to date on all the news. We want to hear from you on Twitter, so hit us up there. You can find me at Carolyn Michelle. You can find our fearless leader at Anita Sarkeesian. And Ebony, where can folks find you?
They can find me at Ebony Ma is a Boss.
Heck yeah. All right. Our producer is Phil Circus, who also composed our theme music. We'll see you next week.
Bye, everybody.